Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our working group chair, Jane Wales.
Good morning. To the hearty, to those who will brave the weather, thank you for being here. This is our final working group session. Actually, we're going to have one more sort of expanded working group session with former Prime Minister Blair, but this is our last intimate one. Now, in this session, we're not going to have our usual table discussion, but your voices will be heard, and the way they'll be heard is by your submitting your questions to your table facilitator during the plenary, the panel discussion, so that we can be sure that they're able to answer your questions directly. There are about 3.3 million mobile phone subscribers in the world, and the majority of those are in the developing world. So rickshaw drivers, farmers, workers of all sorts are being enabled and helped by this important technology. And so we've got a great opportunity here this morning to talk about ways to ensure that we fully leverage this new technology to benefit the poor. And you couldn't have a better set of panelists or a better moderator for this. Sonal Shah runs the program at Google.org, where she heads their global development initiative, and she is a former Clinton administration official from the Department of the Treasury and the White House, and so therefore a former colleague. So we turn it over to Sonal.
Thank you, Jane, and thank you, Jane, to the whole team, your whole team, who's been extremely helpful. I think this is because I work at Google, one of the most interesting sessions, especially when we talk about information and poverty and what does it mean. And in many cases, it's things that we take for granted a lot, especially in the developed world. So, for example, you know, when we want to find a doctor, we can Google the person, we can Google the name, we can Google a location, we can find it. If we want to learn about diseases, we can get online or we can find information about the types of diseases that we find in our areas or in our neighborhoods or in our communities or in our nations. And if we're traveling, we can get access to that information. If we want to find the best school districts, the information is available. You know where you might locate if you move somewhere because the school districts are good, but that information is available. The data is available. And similarly, if you want to know the quality of your air, we know if it's code red, code orange, code green, depending on what the air quality is, we can get access to that information. But a lot of that is information that's either being produced already, it's able to be transmitted so people can use it, and it's the ability to do something with it. So if I wanted to act, I can act on it. Now, in many of the developing countries that we're talking about, this information is not available. Either it's not publicly available or it's not being created. Or it's not being transmitted. And so what we hope this panel will do is really look at the underlying factors to what is information, how do you transmit it so the poor can actually use it, do something with it, whether it's governments in those countries, whether it's providers in those countries, or whether it's the poor themselves, and how can they participate in it. And technology is critical to all of this. How do we use technology? How do we come up? How can technology be helpful? Whether it's mobile phones, whether it's handhelds, which we'll talk about a little bit today, whether it's mobile banking, whether there might be other technologies that we haven't even found yet that we should be creating. But this is an opportunity here to come up with disruptive technologies, because many of the governments we're talking about, or many of the countries we're talking about, are not bound by different regulations and the way different groups work or different states work or any of that. Technology here has an opportunity to really play a disruptive role, and what we hope to discuss in this panel is to talk a little bit about that. And there's opportunities for creative solutions. I think this is really an opportunity, and what I hope you'll get out of some of this panel is really where there's opportunities to take advantage of what each other is doing and how we can use, whether it's different algorithms, different technologies, or platforms that are being created, and how we can do something with that. So let me not waste too much more time and introduce our panel. And the format we're going to have here is I'm going to go right into Q&A sessions with them and open it up then for each of the groups to, or whoever wants to ask questions for about 15, 20 minutes, and then close it with a question back to our panel. panel. So please do have your questions ready, and please don't hesitate to ask them. To my right is Holly Ladd. She is the Vice President and Director of AED Satellite Center for Health and Information Technology. She's dedicated to providing critical public health to health workers in low-income countries. Most importantly, Holly is a leader in this space. She has been looking for innovative ways to leverage technology and get information to communities and workers in the health area. To her right is Brian Richardson. He is the founder and director of Wizit, a South African-based company offering cell phone banking for the poor. This technology works across all networks, all phones, all SIM cards, and it's 24/7 real-time transactions. So we've talked a lot about mobile banking, but here's someone that's been working on it and I think has some really good insights in some of the things that he's learned. To his right is Mary Ellen Iskandarian. She is the president and CEO of Women's World Banking, one of the largest microfinance groups in the world, and with over 20 years of experience in building financial systems in developing countries, and has a variety of experiences, but has been leading WWB's efforts in developing and delivering a wide array of products and services to meet the needs of low-income women. So what we hope to have is a good discussion here. And let me start with Holly. Holly, we've had, 2 million children a year die just from preventable diseases, diarrhea, bad water, no access to basic health care. And in many of these cases, a lot of the problem is that families, communities, doctors, nurses don't have access to information. They don't have access to basic information about healthcare, what to do if something happens, what to do if a child is exhibiting certain types of qualities and there's some problems. So I know you've been working on this through AED Satellite, which is looking at how to get access to information for doctors and nurses and health workers in poor countries. And could you tell us a little bit about what AED Satellite does, but also how do you transmit this information? How do you know what type of information to provide? And how do you train workers to use this information?
Thank you. Well, first of all, let me thank you for including me on this panel. It's a real honor to be with you all today and to share our story. As you heard a couple of days ago when President Clinton and Bill Gates were together on the stage, just the toll of malaria alone in Africa and the number of children it kills each day is staggering. And when you think that for every child who's sick with malaria, you have a parent or caretaker who's not working that day. And when you think about the impact going beyond the individual family to the impact on the community and, in fact, the impact on the country, you're talking about a huge impact on gross national product. Talking about 30% of the workforce, just for malaria alone, being absent from the workplace on any given day. And it's very hard to think about alleviating poverty in a country that has that burden of disease. And so our challenge, and in fact the challenge of all of us here, is to alleviate the burden of disease so that people can alleviate the burden of poverty. When I was surfing the other day, I Googled and found a very interesting comment on the Ministry of Health for the country of Ghana. They see themselves first and foremost as a member of the economic government, the economic sector for the government of Ghana. And their job is to create wealth by creating health. They see that the health of their populace is the most important contribution to bringing their country out of poverty. And they've made a real commitment to link poverty and health in their understanding and in their policy development. Our contribution to it is small. We've been working in this space, as you say, for a long time. Right now, we're delivering peer-reviewed medical journal and public health journal content to people all over the globe for free. But in our programs in Africa, we've gone a step further, and we've been delivering that content to people in the kind of rural health center that you heard about this morning when Rick Warren was talking about his experience in Rwanda. There are health centers in all of the countries in Africa, but particularly the countries where we work, that are staffed by one or two people. One of them might be a nurse, but in most cases, they've gone to nursing school and haven't yet graduated. They're required to provide and expected to provide the health care for their community. And in District of Rakai, for example, there is one doctor for every 19,000 or 20,000 people. The care is provided by nurses and by nursing assistants. And they come to those clinics, and there's no books on the shelves, there's no medical guide, and there's certainly no access to the kind of healthcare information that my child, when he was 13, could get by Googling. They're reliant on what they learned in school and by what they learn occasionally from attending continuing education programs. But when you're in Africa, a continuing education program means that you have to travel a day to the capital or 2 days to the capital, and that you close the health center down while you're gone. So our mission was to find a way to provide continuing education, treatment guidelines, and basic healthcare information in those health centers in a sustainable way. I'm sure many of you have a pocket gadget with you, a PDA or a smartphone. Well, consider that that device can hold an entire medical library. And that's what we've been doing. We've been working with people in Uganda and in Mozambique and in Botswana to pick relevant content that's been approved by the local ministries of health or by the WHO, and to provide that information in a sustainable way to people providing care on the ground. And we use the cellular network and an access device that we've created, an access point, to enable them to continue to update that information. And while they're downloading continuing education, they're uploading their data so that the Ministry of Health has the vital information that they need on what's going on in the community to make appropriate decisions around resource allocation.
Thank you. So, Brian, let me just turn this over in that I know we're jumping from health to finance, but as Holly said, you know, health is just as important to the GDP of the economy as finances. And I think it's important for us to understand, you know, you've been working with WISIT in terms of creating a technology in South Africa that people can use to do mobile banking. It'd be interesting to hear from you kind of how you're doing in terms of in South Africa, but I know you're looking at scale and what some of your challenges have been as you've implemented this technology in South Africa, but as you're looking to scale, where do you see the opportunities and where do you see some of your challenges?
Great. There's estimated to be 5 billion people in the world without access to finance. In South Africa, 11 million people. And we started this venture by really going to the marketplace and trying to find out why. Why do so few people have? And it boiled down to what I'd term the three A's: affordability. Banks were seen as expensive. Accessibility. In South Africa, it takes the average South African 42 minutes to access a financial services point. And finally, availability. Banks traditionally in our country are open from 9 o'clock until 3:30. Most people work from 8 to 5, so you've got a disconnect. Banks, I think, around the world have got a paradigm that says bank equals branches. And I think as long as you've got that paradigm, it becomes almost impossible to bring cost-effective financial services to the unbanked and to the poor. At any one point in time, it's estimated there's about $2 billion under mattresses because that's the only other option. I know it's dangerous to make assumptions, but I'm going to assume that everybody here has got a bank account. And I think many of us may have long forgotten or never experienced what life would be like without a bank account. And I go cold at the very thought of saying for the month of October, I'm going to close my bank accounts, destroy my credit cards, cancel all my standing orders, and just for 1 month live on cash. And I think some of you could try and think of your situation and what it would do to your life. It would probably take 3 working days out of your month just to try and sort your life out. Yet we've got millions of people every day that are faced with no other choice except cash. We live in a fairly crime-ridden society, so people will go to extraordinary lengths to avoid carrying cash. People have this assumption that cash is free. The ultimate cost of cash could be your life in a crime-ridden society, so people will do extraordinary things to move away from it. But one of the ways that you're going to begin to address those three A's is through the use of technology. And I think in discussing it with the developed world and Western world, there's the mindset that says, well, internet banking and the PC will solve the problem. I think in the developing world, probably in my lifetime, that's not going to be a reality. But the one thing that people do have, as was indicated in the slides in the earlier part, is the growth of cell phones. People mightn't have shoes, but they do have a cell phone. And that really led us to a fairly logical conclusion that the cell phone could solve some of the problems. It's always with you. We coined the phrase, my bank in my pocket, because it's always with you, wherever you are. It's certainly available, it's accessible, and it's estimated that it's about a sixth of the cost of processing a normal bank transaction via the mobile phone than it is through traditional bank channels. So it certainly becomes affordable. The challenges we faced is that you've got three different models when it comes to mobile banking. You've got a technology-led model, and this is not about technology, really. It's about a different way of getting to the unbanked. It's about a bank-led model, which is an alliance with a bank. You are dealing with people's money, and it is a highly regulated industry. And one only has to think of some of the AML legislation, the customer due diligence. It adds enormous cost to the business. And I don't think that the legislators and regulators ever had in mind that this legislation would make it more difficult and more onerous to bank the unbanked. That certainly wasn't the purpose behind it. But it is having that side effect, if I may use that word, in terms of the paperwork, the cost of compliance. It just adds enormous to the cost of doing business. And without being too cynical or clever about it, one does have to wonder that a person who's earning $100 a month or less, how much funding of terrorist activities they're actually going to be involved in. So I think we need a pragmatic, reasonable approach to it. But on the cell phone, you can do all of your banking. It saves an enormous amount of time. It's very useful in terms of remittances, sending money home. In most developing economies, you've got a large, well, the economies have been built on migrant labor. People live and work in the cities. Sending money home to their families in rural areas is a necessity, not a nice to have. And it's all facilitated through the phone. The payment of accounts, the purchase of prepaid airtime credits or units, the purchase of prepaid electricity, Africa, everything is prepaid, can be done seamlessly from where you are 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But the regulation is certainly one of the challenges. Getting to the market, creating trust and credibility in the brand, some of the things that we've lived through over the last 3 years, but it's been very exciting, and I think we are starting to make a difference. It's a steep mountain. It's like Mount Everest. We're at base camp one, and we're starting to get there, and we've got some very ambitious plans once we've proven scalability, replicability, and probably importantly commercial viability to take the model globally. We only employ unemployed people. In South Africa, we've got 39% unemployment. So we took a view that we would give opportunities to unemployed people, and we feel very proud of the fact that we've given 3,000 people an opportunity to go and earn an income. So it's a model of getting to the unbanked more than the technology around it.
Thanks, Brian. I just want to pick up on one thread there. I think remittances are something we don't think about enough, and it's not just remittances from developed countries to developing countries, but even remittances within countries. So in places in South Africa, if those that are working in Johannesburg, remitting back to their communities and where they're living, it's very important, and those remittances count for a lot. And sometimes I think those are the overlooked remittances because we're so busy counting the larger ones going from developed to developing countries. But I do think that's an important thing that we should look at. And I know Mary Ellen, through the microfinance institutions, those are really important in terms of access to capital for many of the women that you're working with and through your pieces. And I think, giving access to capital has been a critical part of the microfinance model. And it's the model is changing, the ideas are changing, but the model's not changing, but the ideas are changing. And there's a need or want to do more, whether it's provide health through microfinance institutions, insurance through microfinance institutions, banking, mobile banking, different types of activities. I'd be interested from your perspective, is technology enough for what you're doing? Is there more that needs to be done in order for technology to be used and leveraged more effectively? And kind of what needs to happen for your model to become a platform for other bits of information so communities can have access to that?
Great. Thanks, Sonal, and thank you very much to CGI for including us on this panel. There's been so much focus on microfinance, particularly since the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006. But I think it's always important to remember that to date, really only 133 million people have access to microfinance services. So there is still, any way you slice the numbers, people on earning $1 a day, $2 a day, there's still just a drop in the bucket of those still unbanked. And I see that technology in a variety of ways and greater access to information, and I'll talk a little bit more about what I mean by information, is going to be absolutely essential to building any kind of scale in microfinance. But, you know, sort of follow on Brian's point, and I think one of the real wonderful things about putting this panel where you've placed it today is we've all been able to sort of draw on things that we've learned over the course of the week, and I've learned a great deal from Brian, is his clients are all salaried employees. So they're people who are getting paychecks deposited in a bank account, whereas the vast majority of micro-borrowers, both in the Women's World Banking Network and more broadly, are in the informal sector. And so the almost total lack of information about their work, about their cash flows, to Brian's point also around the anti-money laundering, all of the issues around identification and being known and identified for any money laundering purposes in order to open a bank account. We're starting to see one of our most innovative network members in Pakistan has just gotten their banking license and is moving from becoming an NGO to a commercial bank. And one of their biggest struggles with the central bank right now, and this is an organization that has close to 100% women clients, in keeping those women clients is all around the identification card. And the women do not, by and large, have those cards. Those are in the names of the husbands. And in order to maintain their accounts in their names, that's going to become a huge issue. So I think dealing with issues of identity and information, again, will be a very important contribution that technology can make so that microfinance can continue to have the impact that it has had up until now as it grows increasingly commercial and hopefully grows in scale. But as Sonal was saying, the desire to increase the numbers of products that are offered is really the new trend, and there's a great deal of excitement, and I think really a game-changing shift in microfinance, which is a business that was really grown on credit, is the whole introduction of savings and the ability for the poor, who are already very, very good savers, but again, as Brian, I'm relying a great deal on him, has said, that's money in a mattress. I mean, in some ways, the microfinance industry has been saying to people in the last 30 years, become responsible borrowers, repay your loans on time, build businesses, become entrepreneurs, and then put any money that you earn in your mattress. So I think we're really trying to find effective and safe places to save. But technological solutions there are really, really tough. And in far too many regulatory environments, there, believe it or not, is a requirement for a paper-based receipt. And if a saver, when he or she gives you a deposit, does not get that paper back, you can't take that deposit. So these are things that can be changed, but they're things that really are not being taken on, but I think really lend themselves very, very well to technology as we really start to think about how we can grow microfinance.
Great. Let me ask both you and Holly a question, because I think there's a very interesting link, which I'm not sure we always make, between health and microfinance. But we were talking a little bit earlier, and Holly has all of this data, and when we're talking about the health data, and they have the ability, Holly, to also capture that data of what's happening in communities. So what is the health of the communities that you're in? It's not just a one-way stream of giving information, but it can also be a two-way stream of collecting information, because it's so burdensome to collect information in many countries and in many communities, especially when you're talking about microfinance institutions. But how can you start capturing that data more effectively so you know what the demographics, the dynamics of what's happening in those communities are, and using that information most effectively for things like insurance products? Because you need that for actuarial information, and how do you use that? So how do you think about that data, and where do you think the opportunities are for both of you to not only collaborate, but to really think about how that information can be used as a platform for others to build other products out of it?
Well, we do collect a lot of data. In fact, in the rural health centers in Mozambique, they have 30 forms that they have to submit to the Ministry of Health, either on a weekly or a monthly basis. And in Uganda, where we're in 170 health centers, they have 14 forms that they have to fill out regularly. So there's a tremendous amount of data, and there's a tremendous amount of repetitive data. But what this data tells you is who's in your community, how many people are being born, how many people are dying, how many people are moving, to some extent, and generally speaking, what are the issues that the community is dealing with? And when we put the PDAs in the health centers, we put them there specifically to help collect this data. And I think that we make a mistake when we go into a community and put it into the health center and don't also go into the community and put it into the school and go and put it into the financial office of the district, that we have to start thinking about taking our solutions out of our little sector vertical silos and thinking about building access to information across silos so that a community can have access to its information. The other thing that we learned when we went in is all the information goes in one direction. All of the data was going up. And one of the first conversations I had with a nurse in a rural health center was, do you mean I'm going to get my data back and I'm going to be able to understand what's going on in my community? And I think that's the same issue for all of us, is that when we have data going in one direction, it doesn't help a community do its own planning and its own development and its own growth. So thinking about how many women there are in a community, because you've got that from maternal and child health center, and thinking about that as your audience for economic growth, being able to connect those dots is very important. I think the other thing that you said, which is important in health, particularly where we work, is healthcare providers are women. We're introducing technology into communities and teaching people to use technology, simple though it is, but the first users are women. And what is the impact in the community where you put in a disruptive technology and you challenge original assumptions about who has information? And one of the most rewarding things we've seen is people from the community coming into that health center, because among the things that we send out is copies of news articles from the daily newspapers. And these villages are seeing and reading their national newspaper for the first time and understanding their lives in the context of their country. So I think connecting the dots across and sharing information that's appropriate to share across sectors could be a really wonderful outcome of learning what we're each doing.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I was delighted. I had no idea that there was this kind of health information being collected, because I think another, you know, in the same way that it's going to require technology to scale, it's also going to require the formal mainstream financial institutions to scale. The mainstream banks, the mainstream insurance companies are going to have to be part of the story of growing beyond that 133 million. And both of those types of organizations are very, very used to doing business in their own risk assessment, risk appraisal business. Banks know how to do risk scoring. And when they don't see that there are risk scoring models for people who sell fruit and produce in the market, it's very, very hard for them to develop the risk scoring model. Similarly, health insurance, microinsurance is growing, and there are some very interesting products, particularly in the life area, but there's virtually nothing being delivered in the health area, and there's really nothing being developed in the maternal and prenatal care area. So being able to go back to the mainstream insurance companies and saying, I do have actuarial data, I do have the kind of information that you need to be able to build your risk models so that you can come into this space, it's really no different from the places that you're used to working, I think is really exciting.
And just to add, you know, there is a growing movement for health insurance, and the skills that you have learned about using communication technologies to inform people about deposits and balances and the rest of it are the same tools that we can use to collect on insurance premiums and to pay out on insurance. Likewise, what we're learning from creating algorithms to help healthcare workers understand how to do basic decision making is a kind of technology that you can use to help people in your sector make basic decisions about the instruments, the financial tools that they adopt.
So, Brian, just taking on information streams and algorithms, I think one of the issues with access to finance, and I think this goes to both you and Mary Ellen a little bit, is credit scores and credit information. So the traditional credit information that we have about our bills being paid through credit cards, or, you know, if I shut down my bank account, I wouldn't have a credit score. And in most of the developing world, when we're talking about the clients that Mary Ellen's working with, they don't have those bank accounts, they don't have that credit history. But there are streams of information that you have access to, whether it's through mobile payments, prepaid payments, other ways. Are there opportunities to really be thinking about alternative or different sources of information that exist for the poor? And how do you integrate that data to think about creating credit histories or credit scores for the poor so they, too, can be a part of this formal system that we've created but continue to remain informal because the system in itself just doesn't allow for it?
It's a good point. And we launched as purely a transactional bank. So we can build a transactional history with our client base, which then becomes quite useful in analyzing to provide credit. So at this point in time, we are not in the credit business. But leading on from what Mary Ellen said, we were in Bucamaranga with one of Mary Ellen's members.
Yeah.
And a young lady running her own business, which she'd run for a long time, sewing together garments of clothing. She needed a loan to upgrade the type of sewing machine that she had. And she was sewing together between 900 and 1,200 garments of clothing in a day. Cut a very long story short, she did get the loan. The challenge that she and millions of entrepreneurs like her has is that for her to make her loan repayments takes a 45-minute cab ride to the institution, standing in a line for anything up to 2 hours. It's a very busy microfinance institution, 45 minutes back. Now, you can do the maths. How does she make up 3 hours of lost productivity, which most entrepreneurs have to do in order to go and make those repayments? So the use of technology, that she could sit at her place of work, make that repayment, the loan could be initiated transmitted electronically through the cell phone, it just makes people's lives hugely, hugely much easier.
So, Mary Ellen, I'm going to ask you a question, but for those of you, there are mics around. We're going to start with questions. If you have any questions, please do raise your hand, and we'll get started. But actually, why don't we just get started, and then I'll make it easier. Can we do one right there? Right there in front of you.
Hi, thanks. I'm Donna Katzen, and I work with Shared Interest in South Africa, and we have some common clients with you. And WISIT, I'm here to say, give a little plug, WISIT is fantastic. A question that I have is, have you thought about adapting the WISIT technology to microfinance institutions themselves, not simply for the clients to use, but also for the MFIs, so that loan officers, small groups, savings and borrowings groups, could use the technology and could in that way facilitate the transactions? And is it replicable elsewhere?
Good point. And yes, we are busy looking at it, and Mary Ellen and I are discussing how we can collaborate closer. But it's a great tool for the MFIs to put as part of their product offering a WISIT account to those clients. So it's a wonderful opportunity to increase access. And certainly WISIT's commitment at the CGI was to take our model globally and to expand globally. But we needed to prove the scalability and replicability first. But now we're ready to be much more aggressive in going global.
We have a question right up front.
Roy Sosa with Empower Ventures, Empower Labs. As we look at making investments around the world into mobile technology, the discussion of today's panel is just right on target. Information and poverty alleviation go hand in hand. I think we can talk about the leveraging the information, leveraging technology to deliver information to the end consumer and also to find out more about their patterns so that we can issue credits. The basic steps that many companies, again, like WISIT around the world, have begun to do is to enable the mobile phone as a delivery channel for the disbursements of funds. The question that comes about, especially because there are multiple companies around with multiple standards and multiple approaches, is the information, as we saw on the Internet with companies like Facebook and whatnot, who does it belong to? And we would like to think that the information really should belong to the end consumer, because the reality is that for all of us around here who are passionate about the customer, we'll end up registering the customer, providing some sort of ID, creating some sort of record of that customer, that if the customer were to have access to at least some portion of that, so that if I have an account with WISIT, I can now go to somebody else and say, I have this record, even if I'm not using WISIT for that particular service, or if I have an account with a health organization, to have that portability, just the same way that today my driver's license allows me to do many things, even though it has nothing to do with the DMV. I'm wondering to what extent your thoughts as far as where do you think the information should reside. Obviously, as we invest in businesses and organizations that are trying to grow, there's always this desire to keep the information to ourselves, so because we think that's a competitive advantage or allows us to keep the customers. But I think if we took a longer-term horizon approach, we would be able to see that by empowering the individual to build value on that information, we could potentially end up fulfilling our mission.
That's a great point. And, in fact, Holly, do you want to take that?
Yeah. I'll start because it's a huge issue in health. And in most rural health clinics, they don't keep individual patient records. They use that blue book that we used to take exams in, and the patient takes the record with them in the portable record. But we're moving toward patient record-keeping systems to drive better healthcare delivery. There's an example in Zambia, for instance, where they're using smart cards originally as an approach to provide better HIV and AIDS care. But knowing that they couldn't have the only people with smart cards be the people with AIDS, they started in the maternal child health clinics. And so you have that portable record with that chip on it that's got your data, and you go from health center to health center, and your record follows you. Not only is it retained on the master computer, but it's updated each time you go to the health center. And I imagine there are similar solutions that you're working with.
Well, there's been a huge amount of work done in the area of credit bureaus around the world so that that credit information is more readily available. Unfortunately, most countries have not gone down to that bottom of the pyramid, that very low income. Again, the informal sector population is not recorded in most credit bureaus. But there's a very nice sort of correlation or virtuous circle that in those countries, you know, Peru, for example, which has made a huge effort to drive credit bureau and credit information down to the lowest levels, they have one of the most vibrant and well-regulated microfinance industries. So there's a definite correlation, and particularly just there's a lot of talk about client protection and over-indebtedness or risk of over-indebtedness in the microfinance space. I think that the lack of credit information only, you know, exacerbates the potential for a low-income individual to take on more than one loan or more debt than they can really handle. So the need to build that public good of credit information, even at the lowest levels, is absolutely essential.
I would only add to that to say I think in general making information more publicly available so others can build a platform on top of it is only a net good. So if the information is available and I can build an algorithm on it for what I need and somebody else can build an algorithm on it for what they need and somebody else can build it for another need, I think it's a net good for the world because it is true that many communities and people don't have access to their information, but banks and others do. So it's a very fair point. I think we have a question right back here.
Right. Paul Das from InScap Partners. Just to sort of build on that, and this is something that we have been over the last two odd days thinking about from an infrastructure standpoint, do you see, like we had the idea of microfinance institution and then you have built this whole credit infrastructure, the idea of collecting the information, an institution or a not-for-profit, sort of on an across-the-board basis, building this information, tying into on a vertical basis across microfinance, health, microinsurance in the instance of India in an area of interest to us. Sort of, what I see is a need here to build that infrastructure and tie it back. You can tie it back with the government in the countries that you work with, but then that infrastructure is where some amount of thought and investment and commitment can go into from a private sector, because I have not seen that sort of come about, and I was in India talking about it with a few folks. I think then everyone across the board can sort of benefit from it. How we go about building such an infrastructure, I'd be interested in your thoughts. Thank you.
Brian, do you want to take that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it makes perfect sense. And one of the things that I think I've certainly picked up from this particular gathering is a collaborative model. And we need to broaden that. We need to make the information available. But at the end of the day, it belongs to the consumer, and you need the consumer's permission to certainly share certain types of information.
So we've got a lot of questions. So can everybody just keep their questions specific so we can move on through some of the questions? I think there's one in the back there.
Yes, I'm Martin Burt from Paraguay. Two questions. Why is the panel called Poverty Alleviation and not Elimination? And second, how far are we from putting in a cell phone all the proven, practical, affordable solutions that are out there, but is so fragmented that the people doing successful health programs don't know how to do successful housing programs or running water program? How close are we that Google and its partners solve this problem of lack of information for the consumers more than for the intermediary organizations?
We'll leave your first question for CGI. And the second one, Holly, do you want to take that?
It's a very good question, and you know, we have to think about the problem we're trying to solve in each sector or each person is trying to solve and the appropriate technology or sustainable technology for that person. So for instance, health is for a healthcare worker, health is a very information dense profession. And there is constantly new information coming out all the time about how to use these marvelous drugs and how to use these new treatment methodologies. That kind of information on a cell phone is probably not right. But to have a healthcare consumer, the ultimate consumer, be able to have a very quick database that says, how do I get access to this? Or an SMS number that they punch in that will retrieve for them information on how to use a condom, you know, is a real viable solution and is in fact happening everywhere. I think the problem is that when you're going cross-sector, it's very hard to figure out what is going to be the ultimate information on any device, and we need to let people configure their device to meet their own needs.
So we need to stop the questions. I actually have one question for everybody here, and if you can all make it short, that would be great, because I would just like to wrap up really quickly. So to each of you, if you thought about an investment or in a technology that would be important to invest in now, what would it be? Ellen, do you want to start?
No, actually, this is great because it lets me segue from the last two questions, because I think I would be misleading the audience if I didn't point out the fact that today only roughly 30% of the microfinance institutions that are operational even have MIS systems, even have back office systems. So when we talk about infrastructure, and to your point, actually, the lowest pickup, and this, I know this doesn't make sense given the tech boom in India, the lowest rate of adoption has been in South Asia because labor rates are so low, it's still less money to hire 10 people to keep a big ledger book by hand than to buy one computer. So when we talk about infrastructure, we're really talking infrastructure. So we're really talking about back office. And then just one other thing, there's some real anomalies regionally. You know, Latin America probably is the furthest along. Those institutions do have good back office. And so, you know, if I were to make a grant Latin America dedicated, it would really be about reaching more rural, more remote populations. In India or South Asia, it would be finding a low enough cost MIS solution to link up to the bigger technological infrastructure. And then in Africa, which has actually had pretty good MIS pickup in microfinance institutions, the operational systems, the operational manuals, all of the things that have to be, you know, sort of rigidly in place in order to make technology really sing isn't really well built. And so if we could sort of take one step behind the MIS for Africa and build all of that going into it, those would sort of be the three regional investments I would make.
Brian, keep it
great.
Short,
keep it very short. Our model is turning banking on its head. It's not about getting the unbanked to the bank. It's about getting the bank to the unbanked. And that requires investment. One of the things that I think is critical is in the whole area of financial literacy training and education. The market that we're dealing with needs desperately basic education on managing money.
I have three. One, power solutions for remote environments. That this technology is not going to work if we have to keep buying solar panels at exorbitant prices in order to run the technology. Two, we need a one laptop per nurse. We need a one laptop per each of our sectors. We need a smart device that's built for the environment that we're working in. Instant on, low power consumption, whatever. And then three, my organization's made a commitment to take our work in Uganda from 170 health centers to 1,300 health centers at a cost of about $500 per health center to put a digital library in for each nurse.
Thank you. As you can tell, this is I hope just the beginning of a conversation. There's a lot to be done in the information space, and just in the core aspects of getting access to information and creating the information, to building technological systems that can allow MIS systems for all microfinance institutions, as opposed to individual microfinance institutions having their own individual MIS systems, and the ability to integrate data, health data, environment data, finance data, because it starts beginning to tell richer stories about what's happening in different communities, and finally really thinking about how we can get information to the poor so they can use it and do something with it, as opposed to just providing them with stuff. It doesn't have to be just a push, but how do we get a pull so we also know what their needs are, what they want, and what they can do with it, so giving them a choice. So I hope what you take away from this is there's huge opportunities, real opportunities for disruptive innovations in this space, and to really think about this creatively, because there's an opportunity to think through that.
Thank you, Sanal. I just had a true CGI moment. We're sitting in a panel on information and poverty, and I'm sitting right behind Joseph Stiglitz, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for an economic theory that argued that swift access to information was the key to success. Now, here was what made it a CGI moment. He was taking notes. So let me just give you a quick overview of what we've been through over the last 3 days, because it may have moved in the same blur for you that it did for me. So then we will turn to some important commitments. We really focused here on building assets and on protecting assets and protecting those who were emerging from poverty. From shocks, be they the shocks of climate, be they the shocks of economic turmoil, be they the shocks of poor health, be they the shocks of a drought or a blight of some sort, and to build in the resiliency that is needed. We started with a financial services panel, and we started with the not surprising report from Bob Rubin that there was a crisis of confidence in our economy. I'm not sure there'll be a Nobel Prize for that and that analysis, but his solution is what we'll be eager for. But we were reminded that 2.3 billion people in the world do not have access to financial services, the most basic financial services. And so to reach those, there's a real need not only for innovation, but to bring those innovations to scale. Julio Frank reminded us of a point that he also had the opportunity to make last night, and that is that we are all one disease away from poverty, and that the important thing is to provide health and medical care to the billions, the half a billion in the world who are living in poverty. You at your discussion tables focus on a number of very important points, but I'll just call out a couple, and that is the need to reform the regulatory environment in which financial services are provided, and to improve financial literacy amongst the poor. We then moved on to a panel on food security. And here we were focused both on the short-term crisis, both humanitarian and political crisis that exists, but also on the long-term demand. And Madeleine Albright really framed the issue in national security terms. It was interesting to hear that from a policymaker. And we considered specific efforts to create local markets, to strengthen the supply chain, and to produce to improve productivity in sustainable ways. I mean, sustainable agriculture was an important piece of what we discussed. And you, at your table discussions, talked about the importance of increasing the access to markets, the access to larger distribution networks for small farmers, as well as the access to finance, leveraging information technology, forecasting this conversation. You also talked about the importance of legal frameworks and legal protections and land ownership. We then went on to a conversation about countries and societies emerging from conflict and had a marvelous conversation led by Nicholas Kristof, who is, an extraordinary man. He is more than a journalist, and that's saying a lot by somebody who's the daughter of New York Times reporters and editorial writers. Nick focused on the fact that the most likely country to move into conflict is one that has recently emerged from conflict, and therefore of the importance of our making investments, both philanthropic and financial investments, commercial investments, that will help societies expand their economies but also broaden participation in those economies. But Peter and Donald and Mayo all underscored the girl effect. They spoke to the importance of women being there at the peacemaking table, but also be there as we go through the whole process of reconciliation and rebuilding. They are often the victims of war, but they are not simply victims. They are part of the solution and part of what will make for a healthy and growing society. You, at your tables, talked about the need for skills training, for the reintegration of former combatants, and there was a very heavy emphasis on, of course, youth and the worry about child soldiers. We then teamed up with the climate change track in really a magnificent panel, I thought. A lot of us are worried about the fact that the rich world is largely responsible for the emissions, and the poor world is largely paying and feeling the effects. And there's that fundamental question of what the obligation of the rich world is to the poor world, both in terms of technology transfer and sort of a variety of means of moving beyond our just thinking about mitigation, but thinking about adaptation right now. And we were fortunate to have a series of interesting innovations offered. Dr. Pachauri provided the example of his Lighting a Billion Lives initiative, whereby women entrepreneurs rent out solar-powered flashlights to communities in India that don't have electrification. We heard from President Calderon of Mexico about the Climate Change Fund for all countries. It was his proposal, and Van Jones from Oakland, California, and Judith Roden from right here in New York put forth the need to advance green jobs as part of growing economies and to advance a partnership to what they call the Green Growth Alliance. Across all panels, there was a frequent reference to technology innovation and to the opportunities that new technologies are providing for us. But I think what we probably all came with and will all leave with is that powerful sense that poverty elimination will come from tapping the ingenuity, the entrepreneurial qualities, the industriousness of the poor, to unleashing that which is within them and which they have demonstrated. I think I started our discussion by saying that the poor are good customers, they're a good investment, they're worthy not just in the sense of being deserving, they're worthy in the sense of making good on their promises. And so our entire focus has been on the question of how we can meet our promise to them. And I think what's been most moving for me in the last 3 days was to be not only in the company of superb panelists, but to be in the company of each of you, knowing that you've each made that commitment, each in your own extremely powerful way, and that is the true CGI moment, although Joseph Stiglitz is always my moment. And we really very much look forward to working with you in the year ahead as you act on those commitments. I am now going to call up some commitment makers. I'm going to ask Ray Offenheiser, president of Oxfam America, to take the stage. Ray's my buddy, so we're usually on the phone. Now we get to be on stage together. Jacques Grin, who is CEO of Swiss Re, who we were lucky enough to hear this morning on a plenary. Walter Bell, chairman of Swiss Re America. Walter. They have got a corporate NGO partnership, a cross-sectoral partnership called the Horn of Africa Risk Transfer for Adaptation. It's a commitment to develop weather risk transfer solutions to reduce farmers' exposure to risk, providing security for their livelihoods. Partnering with the Relief Society of Tigray and the International Research Institute and Climate and Society, Swiss Re and Oxfam dedicate $355,000 over 2 years to empower 8,500 people in Ethiopia to adapt to climate change. So please join me in thanking them. Thank you. Ken Banks. Thank you. He's the founder of Kiwanja.net. He is the man on information and poverty. Ken commits $250,000 over 2 years to identify and appoint frontline SMS ambassadors who will enable NGOs working in the challenging environments to enhance the impact of their work. The frontline SMS messaging platform will support efforts as diverse as poverty alleviation, agricultural market development, health application, and election monitoring. So we get governance in there as well. It's through use of an additional 5,000, is this right? By an additional 5,000 nonprofit organizations, Kiwanja's technology has the potential to improve lives of millions across the world. So please join me in thanking Ken for his work. Cherie Blair. We're soon to hear from a certain spouse of Cherie Blair's. Cherie Blair is the founder of Cherie Blair Foundation for Women, and we're really delighted to have you here with us on this rainy day. Through a three-year, $35 million commitment, Women Mean Business, the Cherie Blair Foundation will create a global network to expand women's economic opportunities and business growth potential. They're working in partnership with Harvey Nash Corporation, the Women's Leadership Board at Harvard University, and the International Center for Research on Women. The foundation will inspire a new movement for women to close the gender gap in emerging small and medium-sized enterprises, about which we've heard so much in the last few days. Over the course, there's going to be a three-year pilot phase in countries such as Vietnam, the Palestinian territories, Ghana, Tanzania. This commitment is going to benefit 250,000 women, females, and 13,000 children. So please join me in congratulating Cherie Blair. Would Rory Brooks come to the stage with Fazal Abed and Joseph Stiglitz? You can put down your notepad now. Rory is head of the Rory and Elizabeth Brooks Foundation. Aved is founder and chairperson of BRAC. And Joe Stiglitz is a professor at Columbia University. The Rory and Elizabeth Brooks Foundation, along with its partners, is committing $8.5 million over 3 years to launch the Rajandrapur.
That's in Bangladesh.
Say it right.
Rajandrapur.
Rajandrapur Conversation, an annual event which will take place in the same month as the World Economic Forum in Davos. It'll enable the poor to voice their opinion and suggest adequate responses. And so this commitment will bring together the knowledge of the poor with the expertise of world-class poverty researchers and practitioners to generate ideas and action to eradicate poverty. Each discussion will focus focus on a different theme to inform policy research programs for the partnership between the Brooks World Poverty Institute, University of Manchester, and BRAC Development Institute, and yield practical recommendations. Please join me in congratulating them. Thank you. Finally, I'd like to invite several women and one gentleman to the stage. Terry Babcock-Lemish, Heidi Moseson, Esther Kite, Leslie Harlson, Connor Hartman, Molly Kinder. The deep, dark secret about the Clinton Global Initiative is that each chair assembles a pickup team. And in our case, the pickup team just happens to be the dream team. And these are folks who share your commitment. Their commitment to social change really knows no bounds. Their appetite for hard work, as far as I can tell, is boundless as well. They combine sheer brain power with deep expertise and extraordinary heart. I would say they marry head and heart. And really, their only failing is one that I hope they will continue for the rest of their lives, and that is that they lack the judgment to say no to me when I call. So please join me in acknowledging them. So I want to thank you all. I mean, you can't have a better set of deputies than this, and I know you're all looking with envy. Keep your eyes on these stars. You met them here. We are going to move from this, I think, into our, am I right? We move from this into our luncheon break, and then we are going to have a very special extra session that's in this room, which is the reason you've got translation headsets on your at your seats. So do grab a good lunch and come on back for this very special session before we move into our final plenary. And do join me in thanking this remarkable panel.
One more, my share.